This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Business at the Speed of Thought, Using a Digital Nervous System, written by Bill Gates with Collins Hemingway, read by Jonathan Mayrose.
Introduction. Business is going to change more in the next 10 years than it has in the last 50. As I was preparing for my speech for our first CEO summit in the spring of 1997, I was pondering how the digital age will fundamentally alter business. I wanted to go beyond a speech on dazzling technology advances and address questions that business leaders wrestle with all the time. How can technology help you run your business better? How will technology transform business? How can technology help make you a winner 5 or 10 years from now? If the 1980s were about quality and the 1990s were about re-engineering, then the 2000s will be about velocity, about how quickly the nature of business will change, about how quickly business itself will be transacted, about how information access will alter the lifestyle of consumers and their expectations of business. Quality improvements and business process improvements will occur far faster. When the increase in velocity of business is great enough, the very nature of business changes. A manufacturer or retailer that responds to changes in sales in hours instead of weeks is no longer at heart a product company, but a service company that has a product offering. These changes will occur because of a disarmingly simple idea, the flow of digital information. We've been in the information age for about 30 years, but because most of the information moving among businesses has remained in paper form, the process of buyers finding sellers remains unchanged. Most companies are using digital tools to monitor their basic operations, to run their production systems, to generate customer invoices, to handle their accounting, to do their tax work. But these uses just automate old processes. Very few companies are using digital technology for new processes that radically improve how they function, that give them the full benefit of all their employees' capabilities, and that give them the speed of response they will need to compete in the emerging high-speed business world. Most companies don't realize that the tools to accomplish these changes are now available to everyone. Though at heart most business problems are information problems, almost no one is using information well. Too many senior managers seem to take the absence of timely information as a given. People have lived for so long without information at their fingertips that they don't realize what they're missing. One of the goals in my speech to the CEOs was to raise their expectations. I wanted them to be appalled by how little they got in the way of actionable information from their current IT investments. I wanted CEOs to demand a flow of information that would give them quick, tangible knowledge about what was really happening with their customers. Even companies that have made significant investments in information technology are not getting the results they could be. What's interesting is that the gap is not the result of a lack of technology spending. In fact, most companies have invested in the basic building blocks: PCs for productivity applications, networks and electronic mail, email for communications, basic business applications. The typical company has made 80% of the investment in the technology that can give it a healthy flow of information, yet is typically getting only 20% of the benefits that are now possible. The gap between what companies are spending and what they're getting stems from the combination of not understanding what is possible and not seeing the potential when you use technology to move the right information quickly to everyone in the company. Changing technology and expectations. The job that most companies are doing with information today would have been fine several years ago. Getting rich information was prohibitively expensive, and the tools for analyzing and disseminating it weren't available in the 1980s and even the early 1990s. But here on the verge of the 21st century, the tools and connectivity of the digital age now give us a way to easily obtain, share, and act on information in new and remarkable ways. For the first time, all kinds of information, numbers, text, sound, video, can be put into a digital form that any computer can store, process, and forward. For the first time, standard hardware combined with a standard software platform has created economies of scale that make powerful computing solutions available inexpensively to companies of all sizes. And the personal in personal computer means that individual knowledge workers have a powerful tool for analyzing and using the information delivered by these solutions. The microprocessor revolution not only is giving PCs an exponential rise in power, but is on the verge of creating a whole new generation of personal digital companions. Handhelds, auto PCs, smart cards, and others on the way that will make the use of digital information pervasive. A key to this pervasiveness is the improvement in internet technologies that are giving us worldwide connectivity. In the digital age, connectivity takes on a broader meaning than simply putting two or more people in touch. The internet creates a new universal space for information sharing, collaboration, and commerce. It provides a new medium that takes the immediacy and spontaneity of technologies such as the TV and the phone and combines them with the depth and breadth inherent in paper communications. In addition, the ability to find information and match people with common interests is completely new. These emerging hardware, software, and communication standards will reshape business and consumer behavior. Within a decade, most people will regularly use PCs at work and at home. They'll use email routinely. They'll be connected to the internet. They'll carry digital devices containing their personal and business information. New consumer devices will emerge that handle almost every kind of data: text, numbers, voice, photos, videos, in digital form. I use the phrases web work style and web lifestyle to emphasize the impact of employees and consumers taking advantage of these digital connections. Today, we're usually linked to information only when we are at our desks, connected to the internet by a physical wire. In the future, portable digital devices will keep us constantly in touch with other systems and other people. And everyday devices, such as water and electrical meters, security systems, and automobiles will be connected as well, reporting on their usage and status. Each of these applications of digital information is approaching an inflection point, the moment at which change in consumer use becomes sudden and massive. Together, they will radically transform our lifestyles and the world of business. Already, the web work style is changing business processes at Microsoft and other companies. Replacing paper processes with collaborative digital processes has cut weeks out of our budgeting and other operational processes. Groups of people are using electronic tools to act together almost as fast as a single person could act, but with the insights of the entire team. Highly motivated teams are getting the benefit of everyone's thinking, with faster access to information about our sales, our partner activities, and, most important, our customers. We are able to react faster to problems and opportunities. Other pioneering companies going digital are achieving similar breakthroughs. We have infused our organization with a new level of electronic-based intelligence. I'm not talking about anything metaphysical or about some weird cyborg episode out of Star Trek, but it is something new and important. To function in the digital age, we have developed a new digital infrastructure. It's like the human nervous system. The biological nervous system triggers your reflexes so that you can react quickly to danger or need. It gives you the information you need as you ponder issues and make choices. You're alert to the most important things, and your nervous system blocks out the information that isn't important to you. Companies need to have that same kind of nervous system, the ability to run smoothly and efficiently, to respond quickly to emergencies and opportunities, to quickly get valuable information to the people in the company who need it, the ability to quickly make decisions and interact with customers. As I was considering these issues and putting the final touches on my speech for the CEO Summit, a new concept popped into my head: the digital nervous system. A digital nervous system is the corporate digital equivalent of the human nervous system, providing a well-integrated flow of information to the right part of the organization at the right time. A digital nervous system consists of the digital processes that enable a company to perceive and react to its environment, to sense competitor challenges and customer needs, and to organize timely responses. A digital nervous system requires a combination of hardware and software. It's distinguished from a mere network of computers by the accuracy, immediacy, and richness of the information it brings to knowledge workers and the insight and collaboration made possible by the information. I made the digital nervous system the theme of my talk. My goal was to excite the CEOs about the potential of technology to drive the flow of information and help them run their businesses better. To let them see that if they did a good job on information flow, individual business solutions would come more easily. And because a digital nervous system benefits every department and individual in the company, I wanted to make them see that only they, the CEOs, could step up to the change in mindset and culture necessary to reorient a company's behavior around digital information flow and the web work style. Stepping up to such a decision meant that they had to become comfortable enough with digital technology to understand how it could fundamentally change their business processes. Afterward, a lot of the CEOs asked me for more information on the digital nervous system. As I've continued to flesh out my ideas and to speak on the topic, many other CEOs, business managers, and information technology professionals have approached me for details. Thousands of customers come to our campus every year to see our internal business solutions, and they've asked for more information about why and how we've built our digital nervous system and about how they could do the same. This book is my response to those requests. I've written this book for CEOs, other organizational leaders, and managers at all levels. I describe how a digital nervous system can transform businesses and make public entities more responsive by energizing the three major elements of any business: customer-partner relationships, employees, and process. I've organized the book around the three corporate functions that embody these three elements: commerce, knowledge management, and business operations. I begin with commerce because the web lifestyle is changing everything about commerce, and these changes will drive companies to restructure their knowledge management and business operations in order to keep up. Other sections cover the importance of information flow and special enterprises that offer general lessons to other organizations. Since the goal of a digital nervous system is to stimulate a concerted response by employees to develop and implement a business strategy, you will see repeatedly that a tight digital feedback loop enables a company to adapt quickly and constantly to change. This is a fundamental benefit to a company embracing the web work style. Business at the Speed of Thought is not a technical book. It explains the business reasons for and practical uses of digital processes that solve real business problems. One CEO who read a late draft of the manuscript said the example served as a template for helping him understand how to use a digital nervous system at his company. He was kind enough to say, "I was making one list of comments to give to you, and another list of things to take back to implement in my company." I hope other business readers discover the same how-to value. For the more technically inclined, a companion website at www.speedofthought.com provides more background information on some of the examples, techniques for evaluating the capabilities of existing information systems, and an architectural approach and development methodologies for building a digital nervous system. The book site also has links to other websites I reference along the way. To make digital information flow an intrinsic part of your company, here are 12 key steps. For knowledge work, 1. Insist that communication flow through the organization over email so that you can act on news with reflex-like speed. 2. Study sales data online to find patterns and share insights easily. Understand overall trends and personalize service for individual customers. 3. Use PCs for business analysis and shift knowledge workers into high-level thinking work about products, services, and profitability. 4. Use digital tools to create cross-departmental virtual teams that can share knowledge and build on each other's ideas in real time, worldwide. Use digital systems to capture corporate history for use by anyone. 5. Convert every paper process to a digital process, eliminating administrative bottlenecks and freeing knowledge workers for more important tasks. For business operations, 6. Use digital tools to eliminate single-task jobs or change them into value-added jobs that use the skills of a knowledge worker. 7. Create a digital feedback loop to improve the efficiency of physical processes and improve the quality of the products and services created. Every employee should be able to easily track all the key metrics. 8. Use digital systems to route customer complaints immediately to the people who can improve a product or service. 9. Use digital communications to redefine the nature of your business and the boundaries around your business. Become larger and more substantial, or smaller and more intimate, as the customer situation warrants. For commerce, 10. Trade information for time. Decrease cycle time by using digital transactions with all suppliers and partners, and transform every business process into just-in-time delivery. 11. Use digital delivery of sales and service to eliminate the middleman from customer transactions. If you're a middleman, use digital tools to add value to transactions. 12. Use digital tools to help customers solve problems for themselves, and reserve personal contact to respond to complex, high-value customer needs. Each chapter will cover one or more points. Good information flow enables you to do several of these things at once. A key element of a digital nervous system, in fact, is linking these different systems, knowledge management, business operations, and commerce, together. Several examples, particularly in the area of business operations, focus on Microsoft. There are two reasons. First, customers want to know how Microsoft, a proponent of information technology, is using technology to run our business. Do we practice what we preach? Second, I can talk in depth about the rationale for applying digital systems to operational problems that my company actually faces. At the same time, I've gone to dozens of pioneering companies to find the best practices across all industries. I want to show the broad applicability of a digital nervous system, and in some areas, other companies have gone beyond us in digital collaboration. The successful companies of the next decade will be the ones that use digital tools to reinvent the way they work. These companies will make decisions quickly, act efficiently, and directly touch their customers in positive ways. I hope you'll come away excited by the possibilities of positive change in the next 10 years. Going digital will put you on the leading edge of a shockwave of change that will shatter the old way of doing business. A digital nervous system will let you do business at the speed of thought, the key to success in the 21st century. Part 1. Information flow is your lifeblood. Chapter 1. Manage with the force of facts. The big work behind business judgment is in finding and acknowledging the facts and circumstances concerning technology, the market, and the like, in their continuously changing forms. The rapidity of modern technological change makes the search for facts a permanently necessary feature. Alfred P. Sloan, Jr., My Years with General Motors. I have a simple but strong belief. The most meaningful way to differentiate your company from your competition, the best way to put distance between you and the crowd, is to do an outstanding job with information. How you gather, manage, and use information will determine whether you win or lose. There are more competitors. There is more information available about them and about the market, which is now global. The winners will be the ones who develop a world-class digital nervous system so that information can easily flow through their companies for maximum and constant learning. I can anticipate your reaction. No, its efficient processes, its quality, its creating brand recognition and going after market share, its getting close to customers. Success, of course, depends on all of these things. Nobody can help you if your processes limp along, if you aren't vigilant about quality, if you don't work hard to establish your brand, if your customer service is poor. A bad strategy will fail no matter how good your information is, and lame execution will stymie a good strategy. If you do enough things poorly, you'll go out of business. But no matter whatever else you have going for you today, smart employees, excellent products, customer goodwill, cash in the bank, you need a fast flow of good information to streamline processes, raise quality, and improve business execution. Most companies have good people working for them. Most companies want to do right by their customers. Good, actionable data exists somewhere within most organizations. Information flow is the lifeblood of your company because it enables you to get the most out of your people and learn from your customers. See if you have the information to answer these questions. What do customers think about your products? What problems do they want you to fix? What new features do they want you to add? What problems are your distributors and resellers running into as they sell your products or work with you? Where are your competitors winning business away from you, and why? Will changing customer demands force you to develop new capabilities? What new markets are emerging that you should enter? A digital nervous system won't guarantee you the right answers to these questions. It will free you from tons of old paper processes so that you'll have time to think about the questions. It will give you data to jumpstart your thinking about them, putting the information out there so that you can see the trends coming at you. And a digital nervous system will make it possible for facts and ideas to quickly surface from down in your organization, from the people who have information about these questions, and likely many of the answers. Most important, it will allow you to do all these things fast. Answering the hard questions. An old business joke says that if the railroads had understood they were in the transportation business instead of the steel rail business, we'd all be flying on Union Pacific Airlines. Many businesses have broadened or altered their missions in even more fundamental ways. An unsuccessful maker of Japan's first electric rice cooker became Sony Corporation, a world leader in consumer and business electronics and in the music and movie industries. A company that began by opportunistically making welding machines, bowling alley sensors, and weight reduction machines, moved on to oscilloscopes and computers, becoming the Hewlett-Packard we know today. These companies followed the market to phenomenal success, but most companies are not able to do this. Even when you look at your existing business, it's not always clear where the next growth opportunity is. In the frenetic world of fast foods, McDonald's has the strongest brand name and market share and a good reputation for quality. But a market analyst recently suggested that McDonald's flip its business model. Referring to the company's occasional promotion of movie-inspired toys, the analyst said that McDonald's should use its low-margin burgers to sell a line of high-margin toys, instead of the other way around. Such a change is unlikely, but not unthinkable, in today's fast-changing business world. The important idea here is that a company not take its position in the market for granted. A company should constantly reevaluate. One company might make a great breakthrough into another business. Another company might find that it should stick to what it knows and does best. The critical thing is that a company's managers have the information to understand their competitive edge and what their next great market could be. This book will help you use information technology to both ask and answer the hard questions about what your business should be and where it should go. Information technology gives you access to the data that leads to insights into your business. Information technology enables you to act quickly. It provides solutions to business problems that simply weren't available before. Information technology and business are becoming inextricably interwoven. I don't think anybody can talk meaningfully about one without talking about the other. Taking an objective, fact-based approach. The first step in answering any hard business question is to take an objective, facts-based approach. This principle, easier said than acted on, is illustrated in my favorite business book, My Years with General Motors, by Alfred P. Sloan, Jr. If you read only one book on business, read Sloan's, but don't put this one down to do it. It's inspiring to see, in Sloan's account of his career, how positive, rational, information-focused leadership can lead to extraordinary success. During Sloan's tenure, from 1923 to 1956, General Motors became one of the first really complex business organizations in the United States. Sloan understood that a company could not develop a sweeping strategy or undertake the right ventures without building on facts and insights from the people in the organization. He developed his own understanding of the business from close personal collaboration with his technical and business staffs and by regular personal visits to the company's technical facilities. His greatest impact as a manager, however, came from the way he created working relationships with GM dealers across the country. He constantly gathered information from GM's dealers, and he cultivated close, productive relationships with them. Sloan made a big deal out of fact-finding trips. He outfitted a private railroad car as an office and traveled all over the country, visiting dealers. He often saw between 5 and 10 dealers a day. He wanted to know not just what GM was selling to dealers, but what was selling off the dealers' lots. These visits helped Sloan realize in the late 1920s that the car business was changing. Used cars would now provide basic transportation, Middle-income buyers, assisted by trade-ins and installment plans, would buy upscale new cars. Sloan recognized that this change meant that GM's fundamental relationship with dealers had to change, too, as the automobile business moved from a selling to a trading proposition. The manufacturer and the dealer had to develop more of a partnership. Sloan created a dealer council to meet regularly with GM's senior executives at corporate headquarters and a dealer relations board to handle dealer complaints, did economic studies to determine the best locations for new dealerships, and went so far as to institute a policy of grub-staking capable men who did not have ready capital to form dealerships. Accurate sales information continued to be hard to come by, though. GM's sales figures were inconsistent, out of date, and incomplete. When a dealer's profit position was failing, we had no way of knowing whether this was due to a new car problem, a used car problem, a service problem, a parts problem, or some other problem. Without such facts, it was impossible to put any sound distribution policy into effect, Sloan wrote. He said he would be willing to pay an enormous sum and feel fully justified in doing so if every dealer could know the facts about his business and could intelligently deal with the many details in an intelligent manner. Sloan thought that helping dealers with these information issues would be the best investment General Motors ever made. To address these needs, Sloan set up a standardized accounting system across the GM organization and all dealerships. The important word is standardized. Every dealer and every employee at every level in the company categorized numbers in precisely the same way. By the mid-1930s, GM dealers, the auto divisions, and corporate headquarters could all do detailed financial analysis using the same numbers. A dealership, for instance, could gauge not only its own performance, but also its performance against group averages. An infrastructure that provided accurate information led to a responsive organization that other car makers didn't come close to matching for decades. This infrastructure, what I call a company's nervous system, helped GM dominate automaking throughout Sloan's career. It wasn't yet digital, but it was extremely valuable. Knowing dealer inventory was something GM did better than anyone else, and GM got a huge competitive advantage from capitalizing on this information. And this use of information extended beyond GM's corporate walls. GM used manual information systems to develop the first extranet, a functioning network for GM, its suppliers, and its dealers. Of course, you couldn't get nearly as much information flowing through your company then as you can now. It would have taken too many phone calls and too many people moving paper around and poring over paper records, trying to correlate data and spot patterns. It would have been immensely expensive. If you want to run a world-class company today, you have to track far more and do it far faster. To manage with the force of facts, one of Sloan's business fundamentals, requires information technology. What companies can afford to do, what it makes sense for them to do, what's competitive for them to do, has changed dramatically. Now GM uses PC technology and internet standards to communicate with its dealers and customers. Its solution, GM Access, uses a wide-area satellite intranet for interaction among headquarters, factories, and GM's 9,000 dealers. Dealers have online tools for financial management and operational planning, including total order management and sales analysis and forecasting. An interactive sales tool combines product features, specifications, pricing, and other information. Service technicians have instant access to the most current product and parts information through electronic service manuals and technical bulletins and online parts planning and inventory reports. Email links the dealers with GM headquarters, the factory, and one another. The private dealer solution is integrated with the public GM website, where consumers can get detailed vehicle information. Web technologies provide the foundation for a fundamental shift in the way consumers shop for vehicles, and they position GM for electronic commerce. GM has also said publicly that it needs to reduce costs and improve its relationships with employees. Digital information flow can assist with these efforts, too. Standardizing worldwide is hard in any era. Microsoft's international business grew really fast once we got rolling overseas. We made a point of moving into international markets as early as possible, and our subsidiaries had a lot of entrepreneurial energy. Giving them the freedom to conduct their businesses according to what made sense in each country was good for customers and profitable for us. Our international business shot up from 41% of revenues in 1986 to 55% in 1989. The independence of our subsidiaries extended to their financial reporting, which came to us in a number of different formats, driven by a number of different business arrangements and taxation rules. Some subsidiaries accounted for products from our manufacturing corporation in Ireland based on their cost. Others used a percentage of customer price as the cost. They'd reconcile the actual sales and profits in different ways. Some of our subsidiaries got a commission on direct sales to customers, such as computer manufacturers selling PCs in their countries. Other subs facilitated direct sales from the parent company, and we reimbursed them on a cost-plus basis. The half a dozen different financial models gave us a lot of headaches. Steve Ballmer, then Executive Vice President of Sales and Support, and I had to be pretty agile as we looked at the numbers. We'd be looking at a financial statement, and Mike Brown, then our Chief Financial Officer, would say, "This is a Style 6 subsidiary with cost plus on this or that," meaning the financials were different from the other five models. We'd have to recompute the numbers for that sub in our heads as fast as we could so that we could compare them with other numbers. Not knowing any better, as Mike likes to say, he and our controller, John Anderson, decided to take advantage of the fact that everyone already used PC spreadsheets for other kinds of analysis. They designed a cost basis profit and loss financial that didn't show any of the intercompany markups or commissions. Mike and John showed the new P&L around via email and got quick buy-off on it. When we looked at our subsidiary financials after that, we had a much easier time seeing how we were actually doing, especially when we could pivot the data to see it from several different views. It's hard to overstate the benefit of being able to compare all of this data online. One critical aspect is being able to easily control exchange rate assumptions in any view, so you can see results either with or without the effects of exchange rates. Later on, when we were ready to centralize our sales transactions in one corporate-wide system, we'd already done some of our homework. A lot of companies centralizing their sales systems lose time deciding how they want their financials organized. Because we had already figured that out, we were able to centralize our sales data far more quickly and inexpensively than many other companies. Differentiating your company in the information age. If information management and organizational responsiveness made such a fundamental difference in a traditional smokestack industry 70 years ago, how much more difference will they make propelled by technology? A modern automobile manufacturer may have a strong brand name and a reputation for quality today, but it is facing even greater competition around the world. All car manufacturers use the same steel, they have the same drilling machines, they have similar production processes, and they have roughly the same costs for transportation. Manufacturers will differentiate themselves from one another by how well they design their products, how intelligently they use customer feedback to improve their products and services, how quickly they can improve their production processes, how cleverly they market their products, and how efficiently they manage distribution and their inventories. All of these information-rich processes benefit from digital processes. The value of a digital approach is especially apparent in information-centric businesses, such as banks and insurance companies. In banking, data about the customer relationship and credit analysis are at the heart of the business, and banks have always been big users of information technology. In the age of the Internet and increasing deregulation of financial markets, though, how do two banks differentiate themselves from each other? It comes down to the intelligence of a bank's credit analysis and risk management and its responsiveness in its relationship with the customer. It's brains that gives one or the other bank the edge. I don't mean just the individual abilities of bank employees. I mean the overall ability of the bank to capitalize on the best thinking of all of its employees. Today, bank information systems have to do more than manage huge amounts of financial data. They have to put more intelligence about customers into the hands of business strategists and loan officers. They have to enable customers themselves to securely access information and pay bills online, while the bank's knowledge workers collaborate on higher value activities. Information systems are no longer only about back-end number crunching. They're about enabling information to be put to work on behalf of the consumer. Crestar Bank of Richmond, Virginia, provides banking, mortgage application, and bill payment services over the Internet and its tellers in remote locations, such as supermarkets or malls, can open accounts and initiate loans for customers, all by connecting the customer to the back-end systems by means of digital information flow. I was speaking at a bank roundtable in Canada recently and had some questions about how banks should invest in the Internet. Today, they have back-end database systems that store information, and they have applications for people doing customer service on the phone, and for tellers and for branch banks. Now they're looking at adding new systems to present customers with data over the Internet. They said, "We don't want to pick up the additional cost and complexity of still another interface." I told them that the solution was simple. They should build a great interface for customers to see data over the Internet, then use the same interface to view data internally. They'd have a small amount of additional data that the bank employees would get to see, customer data and background on recent interactions with the customers, but the interface would be the same. If they do the new system on a mainstream platform, they can replace all the different ways of viewing data. Over time, as it makes business sense, they can upgrade the back-end database to new technology. But meanwhile, the Internet interface will simplify their lives, not make them more complex. The new interface becomes the bank, both inside and out. Putting information to work. After the introduction of ENIAC, the first general-purpose computer during World War II, computers quickly proved they were faster and more accurate than humans in many applications, managing the customer records of the largest institutions, and automating almost any mechanical process that could be broken into discrete, repetitive steps. Computers were not functioning at a high level, though. They assisted people, but not in an intelligent way. It takes brains to understand the physics and develop the underlying calculations for the arcs of artillery projectiles or ballistic missiles. It takes an idiot savant, a computer, to do the calculations in an instant. Businesses need to do another kind of work, what Michael Dertouzos, director of MIT's Laboratory for Computer Science and author of What Will Be, calls information work. We usually think of information, a memo, a picture, or a financial report, say, as static. But Dertouzos convincingly argues that another form of information is active, a verb instead of a static noun. Information work is the transformation of information by human brains or computer programs. Information work, designing a building, negotiating a contract, preparing tax returns, constitutes most of the real information we deal with and most of the work done in developed economies. Information as verb activities dominate the terrain of information, Dertouzos says. He estimates that information work contributes 50-60% of an industrialized country's GNP. Dertouzos's insight into information as action is profound. When computers went from raw number crunching to modeling business problems, they began to participate in information work. Even manufacturing firms have always expended much of their energy on information about the work, rather than on the work itself. Information about product design and development, about scheduling, about marketing, sales, and distribution, about invoicing and financing, about cooperative activities with vendors, about customer service. When I sit down with developers to review product specifications, or with Microsoft's product divisions to review their 3-year business plans, or with our sales groups to review their financial performance, we work through the difficult issues. We discuss feature trade-offs versus time to market, market spending versus revenue, headcount versus return, and so on. Through human intelligence and collaboration, we transform static sales, customer, and demographic data into the design of a product or a program. Information work is thinking work. When thinking and collaboration are significantly assisted by computer technology, you have a digital nervous system. It consists of the advanced digital processes that knowledge workers use to make better decisions. To think, act, react, and adapt. Dertouzos says that the future information marketplace will entail a great deal of customized software and intricately dovetailed combinations of human and machine procedures. An excellent description of a digital nervous system at work. Getting the numbers easily. To do information work, people in the company have to have ready access to information. Until recently, though, we've been conditioned to believe that the numbers should be reserved for the most senior executives. A A few executives might still want to hold information close in the interests of confidentiality, but for the most part, access to information has been restricted simply because it used to be so hard to get. It took time, effort, and money to move information around. It's as if even now our mindsets go back to the days when there was this big backlog of work that came from the need to write a custom program every time somebody wanted to see numbers in a new way. It was so expensive to pull data out of a mainframe, and it took so much labor to try to correlate the data, that you had to be at least a vice president to order up the work. Even then, the information was sometimes so inconsistent or out of date that you'd have VPs from different departments show up at high-level meetings with different data. The only way that Johnson & Johnson's CEO, Ralph Larson, could get data about any of Johnson & Johnson's companies in the late 1980s, for instance, was to have the finance department prepare a special report. As we'll see in Chapter 17, things at Johnson & Johnson are different now. Executive information systems evolve. One early effort to improve information flow, at least for executives, was the Executive Information System, EIS. Emerging in the late 1980s, EIS gave executives the ability to get sales information or other data without having to wait months for a special report. EIS was the right idea, but it was limited to senior ranks and wasn't connected up with the other company information systems. EIS tended to be just another proprietary system within a proprietary system. One large U.S. steel company discovered that the information produced by the new tool led senior executives to ask more questions of their subordinates, who didn't have the information to answer them. With the benefit of PC-based platforms, tools for rapid application development, and improved graphical user interfaces, the executive information system has evolved into the enterprise information system, also called a performance measurement system. The new EIS systems are intended to provide information to a wider range of people in an organization. As the vendors of EIS systems move to a standard platform and tools, their roles evolved. The real value they offer is not in building the application, but in helping companies figure out what to do with it. Customers often arrive with their expectations so shaped by the idea that information is hard to get that they don't know what is reasonable to expect from their information systems. A leading EIS vendor, ComShare of Ann Arbor, Michigan, starts out by asking a customer such basic questions as, "What do you want from the system?" and "What are the outcomes you want to measure?" ComShare's sales analysis application comes with 90 specific questions about the kinds of data a company might want: performance, underperformance, regional performance, and so on. ComShare, which offers a mix of systems using standard desktop applications or browsers as the front end, assists the customer with analyzing and shaping the right approach to the problem, and will bring in consultants to help with business process re-engineering if that seems to be needed. Only after analysis and any necessary re-engineering of processes does ComShare deliver the technology. On today's computer networks, you can retrieve and present data easily and inexpensively. You can dive into the data to the lowest level of detail and pivot it to see it in different dimensions. You can exchange information and ideas with other people. You can integrate the ideas and work of multiple people or teams to produce a well-thought-out and coordinated result. We need to break out of the mindset that getting information and moving information around is difficult and expensive. It's just basic common sense to make all of your company's data, everything from the latest sales numbers to details of the 401k plan, just a few clicks away for everyone who can use it. A company's middle managers and line employees, not just its high-level executives, need to see business data. It's important for me, as a CEO, to understand how the company is doing across regions or product lines or customer segments, and I take pride in staying on top of those things. However, it's the middle managers in every company who need to understand where their profits and losses lie, what marketing programs are working or not, and what expenses are in line or out of whack. They're the people who need precise, actionable data because they're the ones who need to act. They need an immediate, constant flow and rich views of the right information. These employees shouldn't have to wait for upper management to bring information to them. Companies should spend less time protecting financial data from employees and more time teaching them to analyze and act on it. Of course, every company is going to draw the line on information access somewhere. Every company keeps salaries confidential. In general, though, I believe in a very open policy on information availability. There's incredible value in letting everybody involved with a product, even the most junior team member, understand the history, the pricing, and how the sales break down around the world and by customer segment. The value of having everybody get the complete picture and trusting each person with it far outweighs the risk involved. In many companies, the middle managers can be overwhelmed by day-to-day problems and not have information they need to fix them. They may have reams of data in front of them, literally reams of paper reports, that are difficult to analyze or correlate with data in other reports. A sign of a good digital nervous system is that you have middle managers empowered by the flow of specific, actionable information. They should be seeing their sales numbers, expense breakdowns, vendor and contractor costs, and the status of major projects online, in a form that invites analysis as well as coordination with other people. The system should notify them of unusual developments according to the criteria they set. For example, if an expense item is out of line. This way, they don't need to monitor normal expense activity. These capabilities are available at a few companies, but I'm continually surprised by how few companies use information technology to keep their line managers well informed and to avoid routine review. I'm amazed by the tortuous path that critical information often takes through many Fortune 500 companies. I'm spoiled by being able to email a view of the latest data to key managers and let them dig into it. At McDonald's, until recently, sales data had to be manually touched several times before it made its way to the people who needed it. Today, McDonald's is well on the way to installing a new information system that uses PCs and web technologies to tally sales at all of its restaurants in real time. As soon as you order two Happy Meals, a McDonald's marketing manager will know. Rather than superficial or anecdotal data, the marketer will have hard factual data for tracking trends. As we'll see in the description of Microsoft's reaction to the Internet, still another sign of a good digital nervous system is the number of good ideas bubbling up from your line managers and knowledge workers. When they can analyze concrete data, people get specific ideas about how to do things better, and they get charged up about it too. People like knowing that something they're doing is working, and they like being able to demonstrate to management that it's working. They enjoy using technology that encourages them to evaluate different theories about what's going on in their markets. They get a kick out of running what-ifs. People really do appreciate information, and it's a big motivator. A final sign of a good digital nervous system is how focused your face-to-face meetings are and whether specific actions come out of them. Pilots like to say that good landings are the result of good approaches. Good meetings are the result of good preparation. Meetings shouldn't be used primarily to present information. It's more efficient to use email so that people can analyze data beforehand and come into a meeting prepared to make recommendations and engage in meaningful debate. Companies struggling with too many unproductive meetings and too much paper don't lack energy and brains. The data they need exists somewhere in the company in some form. They just can't readily put their hands on it. Digital tools would enable them to get the data immediately from many sources and to be able to analyze it from many perspectives. GM's Alfred Sloan said that without facts, it's impossible to put a sound policy into effect. I am optimistic enough to believe that if you have sound facts, you can put a sound policy into effect. Sloan did many times over. At today's pace of business change, we need even more to manage with the force of facts. What I'm describing here is a new level of information analysis that enables knowledge workers to turn passive data into active information, what Michael Dertouzos calls information as a verb. A digital nervous system enables a company to do information work with far more efficiency, depth, and creativity. Business lessons. Information flow is the primary differentiator for business in the digital age. Most work in every business is information work, a term coined by Michael Dertouzos to describe human thought applied to data to solve a problem. Middle managers need as much business data as senior executives, but often have less. Unproductive meetings or meetings that largely involve status updates are signs of poor information flow. Diagnosing your digital nervous system. Do you have the information flow that enables you to answer the hard questions about what your customers and partners think about your products and services, what markets you are losing and why, and what your real competitive edge is? Do your information systems simply crunch numbers in the back room or help to directly solve customer problems? Chapter 2. Can your digital nervous system do this? A firm's IQ is determined by the degree to which its IT infrastructure connects, shares, and structures information. Isolated applications and data, no matter how impressive, can produce idiot savants, but not a highly functional corporate behavior. Steve H. Haeckel and Richard L. Nolan, Managing by Wire, Using IT to Transform a Business. Like a human being, a company has to have an internal communication mechanism, a nervous system to coordinate its actions. All businesses focus on a few basic elements: customers, products and services, revenues, costs, competitors, delivery, and employees. A company has to carry out and coordinate the business processes in each area, especially activities that cross department lines. Sales needs to quickly find out whether the company has the inventory or can get it quickly before promising delivery on a big order. Manufacturing needs to know what product is selling like gangbusters so that it can shift production priorities. Business managers throughout the company need to know about both and a whole lot more. An organization's nervous system has parallels with our human nervous system. Every business, regardless of industry, has autonomic systems, the operational processes that just have to go on if the company is to survive. Every business has a core process at the heart of its corporate mission, whether it's the design and manufacture of products or the delivery of services. Every business has to manage its income and expenses, and every business has a variety of administrative processes such as payroll. No company will prosper for long if products don't go out the door or if the bills and the employees don't get paid. The need for efficiency and reliability has driven the rush to automate many basic operations. With managers using whatever solutions were available, the result over time has been a proliferation of incompatible systems. Each independent system may operate smoothly on its own, but the data in each is isolated and hard to integrate with the data in the others. What has been missing are links between information that resemble the interconnected neurons in the brain. Extracting data from operational processes and using it in a meaningful way has been one of the more intractable problems of business. Although automation has been valuable, today's technology can make basic operations the cornerstone of a much broader, corporate-wide intelligence. A company also needs to have good business reflexes to be able to marshal its forces in a crisis or in response to any unplanned event. You might get a call from your best customer saying he's going with your biggest competitor, or that competitor might introduce a hot new product, or you might have a faulty product or an operations breakdown to deal with. Unplanned events calling for a tactical response can be positive, too. You might get an unexpected opportunity for a major partnering activity or an acquisition. Finally, there's the conscious directing of your company's muscles. Whether you're creating teams to develop new products, opening new offices, or redeploying people in the field to go after new customers. To be carried out well, these planned events need deliberation, strategic analysis, execution, and evaluation. You need to think about your company's fundamental business issues and develop a long-term business strategy to solve problems and take advantage of the opportunities your analysis unearths. Then you need to communicate a strategy and the plans behind it to everybody in the company and to partners and other relevant people outside the company. More than anything, though, a company has to communicate with its customers and act on what it learns in that communication. This primary need involves all of a company's capabilities: operational efficiency and data gathering, reflexive reach and coordination, and strategic planning and execution. The need to communicate effectively with your customers will come up again and again in this book. I'll show how a digital nervous system helps successful companies bring all of their processes to bear on this most important mission of all organizations. A digital nervous system serves two primary purposes in the development of business understanding. It extends the individual's analytical abilities the way machines extend physical capabilities, and it combines the abilities of individuals to create an institutional intelligence and a unified ability to act. To put it all together in the right context, A digital nervous system seeks to create corporate excellence out of individual excellence on behalf of the customer. Making data available every day. One way to think of a digital nervous system is as a way to give your internal staff the same kind of data for daily business use that you give a consultant for a special project. With their years of experience in the industry and their expertise in business analysis, consultants often come in with fresh ideas and new ways of looking at issues. After crunching through census-type demographic and sales data, consultants invariably surprise senior management with their profitability analyses, their comparisons to competitors, and their insights into better business processes. From another perspective, though, it's just crazy that somebody outside your company receives more information than you use for yourself. Too often, important customer and sales information is pulled together on a one-time-only basis when consultants arrive. You should have that information available on an ongoing basis for your regular business staff. If consultants get more insight from your systems than you do, it should be because of their unique abilities, not because you prepare information especially for the consultants that isn't otherwise available to your staff. If a consultant can find trends in your data that you can't, there's something wrong with your flow of information. Not all of your managers will have the expertise or breadth of knowledge that a consultant brings to your business, but your manager should have access to data of the same quality. They should be able to walk into work every day and see the freshest data and be able to analyze it in numerous instructive ways. As we'll see in the following example, good things happen when they can. Informing strategic planning. Since our direct sales force calls only on large corporations and partners, Jeff Rakes, our Group Vice President of Sales and Support, wrestles every year with the question of how to improve the effectiveness of our marketing to small and medium-sized customers. We usually reach these customers through seminars, co-marketing activities with partners, and similar broad reach programs. Jeff had been reviewing various approaches to reach our smaller customers. Should we do more marketing in the larger cities since more small and medium-sized customers are concentrated there? Or should we expand our activities into the next half dozen cities in each district according to population size? Given limited resources, what would be the best approach? In Microsoft's culture of numbers, you have to have good factual data to convince people of almost any business proposition, and no one had convincing evidence of the best way to proceed. Then somebody remembered an analysis Pat Hayes, operations manager for Microsoft's Central Region, had done. Pat had rationalized travel budgets among districts that had most of their customers in a major city, such as Chicago, and districts that had most of their customers dispersed across several states. His study had identified some small outlying cities with high concentrations of PC ownership. Would these cities be the best untapped source of new revenue? Pat and a small team were charged with determining the best new marketing opportunities on a region-wide basis, 18 U.S. states and Canada. What happened in the 2 months between November 1996 and January 1997 illustrates how the typical digital tools that many knowledge workers already have can integrate with back-end financial systems to help companies improve their sales. How do you go about identifying the cities with the best sales potential among hundreds of cities of different sizes? What are the right metrics? How do you develop a marketing program that doesn't call for hiring dozens of people and spending tens of millions of dollars? You begin by putting the information you have to work. Pat and a couple of other people began by culling data from MS Sales, our mission-critical revenue measurement and decision support system. This PC-based data warehouse has information from every reseller worldwide on the sales of every version of every product we sell. More than 4,000 employees use MS Sales regularly for decision support, supply chain management, sales force compensation, month-end general ledger close, fiscal budget planning, R&D planning, and market share analysis. From the internet, the team grabbed U.S. Census data that showed the average number of employees per company per city. From an outside consulting firm, the team got information on the number of PCs per city. From field marketing managers around the region, the team mutually gathered information on seminars and other marketing activities in each city. Finally, the team included a list of the number of Microsoft partners in each city. This research, begun by two people using email, intranet postings, and the phone to communicate, ultimately involved dozens of people around the country. After merging and scrubbing all the data, Pat and the team began to analyze it in several different ways. Sometimes independently, sometimes in collaboration, and always with our electronic tools, they tried to spot a correlation between sales numbers and marketing activities across cities of varying sizes. MS Sales provided two sets of data that proved crucial. Last year's sales data, which enabled them to calculate growth, and revenue by postal code. Having revenue numbers at the postal code level enabled very granular analysis by metropolitan area. With the census and PC data, they could create two other important metrics, revenue per PC and revenue per each company's employee. By early January, when they had identified 80 cities that were likely candidates for a new marketing campaign, Pat and the team met with Jeff Rakes. Jeff suggested that they develop a performance index and an activity index for each city. The indexes would provide the common measurement they had been looking for in order to understand the relationship among revenue, PC density, and marketing. The performance index would be the percentage of revenue divided by the percentage of PCs in the region. The activity index would be the percentage of all attendees at Microsoft events who were from the region divided by the percentage of PCs in the region. A number greater than 1 would mean that the city was outperforming other cities. A number below 1 would mean that the city was underperforming. With a consistent set of metrics, the little group didn't have to have philosophical discussions about whether a city was in the Sun Belt or the Rust Belt, or whether the economy in that area was generally good and therefore our sales should be up. Instead, the discussion was straight math. They could relate each city's performance to every other city's and to the presence or absence of marketing activities. Most important, they had a way to extrapolate potential sales for those cities in which we were not doing any marketing at all. A number of small cities looked very promising. I first heard about the project at the executive review in late January 1997, when Jeff presented the data. We were all intrigued and gave him the go-ahead to pursue a test-and-invest marketing strategy for some of these smaller cities. Before we spend big bucks, we want to find out on a small scale whether our idea will work. Jeff emailed Pat and told him to draw up a final set of recommendations for a pilot program and to plan to review it with Jeff within 2 weeks. The day before that meeting, Pat and an associate were working on the final recommendations. Using his list of the number of Microsoft partners in each city, Pat had created a new index for partners to indicate the relative potential for co-marketing activity.